welcome to BioUnethical, the podcast where we question existing norms in medicine, science, and public health. I'm Sophie Joubert, a PhD candidate in philosophy at MIT.
And I'm Leah Pearson, an MD-PhD candidate at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
Before we begin today's episode, a brief content warning. This episode contains discussions of suicide, suicidal ideation, and symptoms of mental illness. Please take care of yourself, and if you or someone you know or love is struggling, please don't hesitate to ask for help. You can always call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
Our guest today is Dr. Marie Nicolini. Marie is a psychiatrist, bioethicist, and assistant professor in psychiatry, neurosurgery, and neuroscience at UT Southwestern in Dallas. Marie's research focuses on questions about autonomy, decision-making capacity, and informed consent, especially as they arise in discussions of psychiatric euthanasia, assisted death, and suicide prevention. She also engages in public policy work and writing. Last year, she testified to the Canadian Parliament as an expert witness on the issue of assisted death for mental disorders. Marie has an MD and PhD in bioethics from KU Leuven University in Belgium.
Our conversation with Marie is about the complicated and contentious issue of medically assisted death, and especially medically assisted death for those suffering from intractable mental illness. You'll mostly hear us refer to this as medical aid in dying or medical assistance in dying, abbreviated as MAID. The terminology in this area is a bit of a mess. What you need to know, though, is that we're using medical aid in dying as an umbrella term for two different ways in which clinicians can help patients end their lives. One is by prescribing a lethal drug that patients then ingest. This is sometimes called physician-assisted suicide, though some object to that term. It's the only kind of assisted death that's allowed in any part of the United States. The second kind of assisted death involves a clinician injecting a lethal drug. The term euthanasia is typically reserved for this practice. While some people think that the distinction between these two types of medical aid in dying is ethically significant, that's not a debate that we touch on today. So we'll just focus on the broader category of MAID.
Some form of medical aid in dying is legal in about a dozen countries around the world. This includes Belgium, where Marie trained and practiced psychiatry, as well as the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Canada, and parts of the United States. In most of these places, there is a terminal illness or prognosis requirement. For example, in the U.S., where MAID is legal in 10 states and Washington, D.C., you cannot receive MAID unless you have a terminal illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live. Elsewhere, though, things are different. In Belgium and the Netherlands, for instance, medical aid in dying has been legal for a little over 20 years and has been tolerated for even longer. And although the majority of recipients in these countries have had incurable cancer, there has never been a terminal illness requirement. This means the door has always been open, not only to MAID on the basis of non-life-threatening physical disabilities and illnesses that progress more slowly, but also on the basis of psychiatric conditions. In Canada, meanwhile, MAID was legalized in 2016 for those facing a, quote, reasonably foreseeable death, but that clause was later dropped, and as of next year, it will be possible to receive MAID on the sole basis of a mental illness.
To give you a sense of the numbers here, in the Netherlands, about 7,700 people received MAID in 2021. This made up about 5% of deaths in the Netherlands that year. The number of people receiving MAID for mental illness remains extremely low, though it is growing. In the Netherlands, a 1997 study estimated that there were between 2 and 5 cases. In 2013, there were 42 reported cases. In 2021, there were 115. In Canada, the overall number of people receiving MAID has been rising much faster over the past 3 years than it has in other countries where MAID is legal. It rose by about 30% from 2020 to 2021, as opposed to rising about 10% in Belgium and the Netherlands. This leads some people to think that we'll see more rapid growth in MAID for mental illness in Canada over the coming years, as it becomes legal, than we have seen in Europe.
We can read off numbers all day, but each of these numbers represents a person, someone with one or more psychiatric conditions so unbearable and intractable that they sought medical assistance in ending their life. Many of these people's records are publicly available online in government-issued reports from countries where the practice is legal. We went back and forth on whether to include any of these stories here. On the one hand, as with many topics in bioethics, discussions of MAID risk getting too technical and abstract, and bringing in specific cases can serve to humanize the conversation. But at the same time, in this context, doing so risks feeling voyeuristic and can constrain the kinds of examples we call to mind when thinking about the broader issues. Ultimately, we decided to paraphrase a handful of cases.
I pulled four cases from the Dutch annual reports, and from what I can tell, they are fairly representative in terms of patients' genders and ages and the types of psychiatric conditions that they have. These are all cases that, according to the Oversight Committee, were handled properly, which is also representative since the vast majority typically are. More content warnings here. The cases mention trauma, disordered eating, and various common treatments for mental illness. If you prefer to skip them, just jump ahead to about 9 minutes and 50 seconds. And if you want more detail, you can find links to the reports in our episode notes.
2021, case number 148. The patient, a woman in her 70s, had suffered from severe recurring depression for 25 years, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder and liver problems, and had attempted suicide several times. She had tried every form of treatment available. Her depression persisted, and she continued to relive her traumas. There was little she was capable of doing anymore, and she no longer experienced any periods of improvement. Feeling mentally and physically exhausted, she requested medical aid in dying. She was lucid and clear in her conversations with the physicians and was able to assess her situation well and reflect clearly on her wish to end her life. All the physicians involved in her case agreed that she suffered unbearably without the prospect of improvement and that there were no reasonable alternatives.
2014, case number 70. The patient, a woman in her 30s, suffered from borderline personality disorder and associated self-harm, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a tendency to dissociate. In the 20 years before her death, she spent 14 of those years in psychiatric institutions in connection with suicide attempts, self-harm, feelings of depression, depersonalization, and helplessness. She frequently relived her past traumas and suffered from nightmares and noises in her head, as well as eating problems and compulsive thoughts and actions, all of which left her feeling exhausted. She often experienced contact with other people as a threat, and everyday life to her was a constant, almost impossible challenge. Despite undergoing all treatments offered to her, including medications, EMDR therapy, emotion regulation skills training, a stabilization course, and day treatments focusing on structure, her symptoms did not improve. About a year before her death, the patient attempted suicide. After that, she made a request for euthanasia. She was then treated with lithium and quetiapine, but these did not have the desired effect. Both her physician and the psychiatrist he consulted concluded that the patient grasped the consequences of her request, that her request was voluntary and persistent, and that she suffered unbearably without prospect for improvement.
2019, case 121. The patient, a man in his 60s, had suffered from a mood disorder since his late teens. His suffering consisted of constant anxiety and social isolation. He spent his days almost entirely in his room or on the balcony and dared only go outside in the evening. Whenever he went outside, he suffered from paranoia and delusions. He had moved into sheltered housing, and his increasing dependence on others for his personal care felt unbearable to him. As a young man, the patient was admitted to institutions for long periods of time. He also received prolonged outpatient treatment. He tried many pharmaceutical therapies, which were either unsuccessful or had too many side effects. 5 years before his death, he was admitted to an institution after attempting suicide, and although he underwent ECT, he did not experience any improvement. Both his physician and the psychiatrist she consulted concluded that he was decisionally competent, that he suffered unbearably, and that his prognosis was poor.
2016, case number one. The patient, a woman in her 60s, had suffered from anorexia nervosa since her youth. She also suffered from more and more frequent episodes of depression. And she had a personality disorder and a somatoform pain disorder, a condition involving numerous physical symptoms for which no physical explanation can be found. She had received extensive inpatient and outpatient treatment, including ECT, pain medication, cognitive behavioral therapy, and treatments specific to medically unexplained physical symptoms. These treatments didn't result in any meaningful changes, and her condition was deteriorating. She experienced her suffering as unbearable and asked her physician for medical aid in dying. The physician consulted an independent psychiatrist who agreed that it was extremely doubtful she would be able to tolerate any further treatments or be able to enter into and maintain an appropriate treatment relationship, partly because she expressed no longer feeling motivated to undergo treatment of any kind. They found her request to be voluntary and well considered.
Made for Mental Illness raises a host of difficult philosophical and practical questions. and there are a lot of different ways our conversation with Marie could have gone. Our approach was informed by certain background normative commitments we hold, some of which are worth surfacing. Both of us believe that, in principle, there can be circumstances in which it is ethically permissible for a physician to assist a patient in ending their life because they are suffering from mental illness.
We think it is in principle possible for someone experiencing mental illness to reason competently and well, and to come to the conclusion that they want to end their life. We think people have a right to make that decision for themselves, and we do not think they should be forced to use the other, less humane methods available to them. In our eyes, the proper function of the medical profession has to do with relieving suffering and facilitating good and flourishing lives, not with preserving life for its own sake.
The question for us, then, is really whether, at the policy level, it's possible to legalize and regulate the practice of made for mental illness in a way that's ethically acceptable. We think there are genuine concerns about whether, at this point in time, that is possible, and we discuss many of these concerns with Marie.
We've broken down these concerns into two broad categories. The first is worries people raise about the requirements, safeguards, and oversight mechanisms that govern medical aid in dying. Questions like, are they enough? Should they be different with regard to mental illness and other types of illness?
In places where medical aid in dying is legal, there are generally three kinds of requirements patients have to meet to receive it. First, voluntariness. Their decision must be voluntary, which also means they must be decisionally competent or capable of making medical decisions. Second, suffering. Their suffering must be unbearable or grievous. And third, irremediability. Their condition must be irremediable, meaning that there must be no reasonable treatment options or cures available. In addition to these, there are often logistical safeguards in place, like required wait times or cooling off periods between the time that someone requests MAID and receives it, age limits on who can receive MAID, and rules about how many clinicians and what kinds of clinicians must be involved in approving a patient's request.
The second category is concerns that, at least to some extent, would apply even if the safeguards were adequate. For example, is MAID for mental illness inherently at odds with suicide prevention? Might it take the onus off government to ensure access to quality mental health care and social services? What message does it send about the value of lives of mentally ill people? With that said, let's get into the interview. As always, you can access the papers we reference, as well as resources related to this episode, at our website, bioenethical.com, and can submit feedback there or email us at bioenethical@gmail.com. Hi, Marie. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you recently wrote a piece for Psych magazine called Should Assisted Death Be Available for Intractable Mental Illness? And the article begins with the sentence, quote, "As a psychiatrist, I'm extremely wary of even the most careful provisions of assisted dying for people with mental illness." Could you start by saying just a little bit about what leads you to be so wary?
Thank you for the question, and we're delving right in there. I think part of what makes me and many people wary is that, you know, it's an unprecedented type of question and type of dilemma that we're facing as a society and at policy level and at the level of medicine. And we're at the very beginning of even understanding what the practice looks like, and perhaps more importantly, sort of unraveling what the, you know, core conceptual questions are, right? So it's part of it is sort of cautionary tale of like, hey, you know, we need to understand what we're doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's get into some more of those details. As we said, some of the most pressing concerns about legalizing MAID, and especially about legalizing MAID for mental illness, have to do with the difficulty of formulating and putting into practice appropriate requirements and safeguards.
The first of these safeguards that we want to focus on is the voluntariness condition. In order to receive medical aid in dying, a patient's request has to be deemed voluntary. And in order for a choice to be voluntary, in general, someone has to have decision-making capacity with regard to that type of choice. Roughly, this means she has to be able to understand and appreciate the risks and benefits of the choice, reason about it coherently, and express her decision. Then, in addition to having decision-making capacity, she has to have made her request in the absence of coercive pressure from others. Now, many people worry that psychiatric disorders can, at least in some cases, render people incapable of making voluntary decisions. But it seems that some people think that having a mental illness is fundamentally in tension with making voluntary choices, or at least with making voluntary choices about whether to end one's own life. So I guess we're wondering, how do you go about thinking about the relationship between mental illness and voluntariness? And what do you make of the quite extreme view that people with mental illness just can't make voluntary decisions about whether to end their lives across the board?
Yeah, to that latter and important question, I think it's a given that people with mental disorders, you know, broadly, I mean, we're talking about 1 in 5 Americans have some type of mental issue. I mean, it seems to me a little absurd to just assume that someone with a mental illness couldn't have mental capacity. I mean, of course, yes, sometimes people do not meet the bar of what we in medicine consider to be, you know, threshold for capacity, but this sort of blanket assumption doesn't really make sense, I think, to me. On the other hand, I think often behind that kind of worry is the worry, again, of, well, how do we define what it means to make a voluntary request? And how do we even define voluntariness? I mean, not to get too much in the weeds, right? But external voluntariness, right? So it should be free from external pressure. And that's the thing people often focus on. And it's important. You don't want family members or doctors or people to pressure someone into making a request. But what does the internal aspect of voluntariness mean, right? And that's sort of the core of what people get at. I mean, on a charitable understanding of when people say that in the US and elsewhere, I think what they mean is, yeah, but how do you really know that their thoughts aren't interfering or aren't clouding? How do you make that distinction? And I think the worry is, well, what kind of tools do we have to make that distinction? It's a huge question. And we're sort of left with our tools that are perhaps too coarse-grained.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, we're inclined to agree with you that obviously you can have mental illness and have decision-making capacity to make lots of kinds of decisions. But it seems like in the case of people with mental illness seeking MAID, there's this particular kind of worry. You used the word like clouding of judgment, like the mental illness itself is sort of precluding the voluntariness of this specific kind of decision. Like, we want to figure out, is the mental illness itself clouding judgment, or is someone having mental illness and also having clear judgment about wanting to receive MAID? And I guess I'm wondering, are there tools that have been developed to kind of make this distinction and evaluate decision-making capacity in patients with mental illness who are seeking MAID?
You know, it's an area of discussion right now, actually, because the countries that have those requirements, and especially the, you know, informed consent, they follow sort of informed consent the way we use it in medicine. So capacity sort of is what does the work. And it's that sort of the model that's been presented to follow. The bigger question for me really is the sort of higher level question that we have in this debate, and actually not just limited to mental disorders, but to all chronic disabilities, is, well, to put it simply, you know, is death a good or a bad thing in this decision, right? Do we consider death to be a good thing? I mean, euthanasia means good death. So we really need to clarify, okay, are we talking about a decision a person has to make that we consider to be in their best interest, as opposed to, you know, thoughts about suicide, where we consider death to be a bad thing?
So is your thought there that the goodness or badness of the decision itself, or what the stakes are, should partly determine how high our threshold is for how clear a person's judgment needs to be? And so we kind of need to decide first, is dying actually good for them or bad for them, before we can figure out what the threshold should be for how clear their judgment needs to be?
Yeah, I think that's right. Because in the absence of that clarification, you get the type of discussion that we see where some say the threshold should be higher than what we usually use in medicine. So some say we use the same sort of model where we test capacity, right? We have a physician testing capacity, but threshold should be higher because let's just assume it's high risk and let's just say threshold should be higher, right? That's one view. Others, though, say, look, people suffer so much that if this is what they want and what's best for them, maybe we should sometimes lower the threshold.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it sort of seems at first pass weird to think that this notion of capacity should be tied to this idea of whether care is good or bad for you. But I think in practice, it's actually something we do all the time in medicine. You know, if a patient's in the ICU and we say, like, can we put an IV in you? And they're like, sure. if we think they need the IV, we're not going to like do a capacity assessment to make sure that they're making an informed decision, right? If the patient is making decisions in ways that seem aligned with what is in their interest, then we generally, we're pretty chill about capacity, might be one way of putting it. And so I guess one way of thinking about it is, what prior do you have about what decision it seems reasonable to make? And then when a patient is making decisions that seem reasonable, then this sort of suggests or provides some additional evidence that they have capacity. And it's only in cases where it starts to seem like the patient is making decisions that look unreasonable, which in the case of MAID would be like, you know, where it doesn't really seem like this would be a good thing for this person to die. That's when the capacity concern becomes more acute.
Yeah, you're raising great points, because the comparison with what we do in medicine, because I mean, two sort of points. One, for example, the example of an IV or all sorts of, you know, urgent intervention that we do, we typically do to save someone's life and sort of assuming that, you know, if they were to die, it would be bad for them. The analogy people sometimes make, and which could come closer, you know, is to say, well, we make similar decisions about deaths all the time when we decide to stop life-sustaining treatment, for example, right? And if someone has capacity to say, yes, I understand that if you stop this life-sustaining treatment, I'll die. The reasoning is, well, then, you know, they should be able to make that decision. And if they have capacity, then it's the same thing. And, you know, the way I see it is that what we need to keep in mind is that this only works if you consider stopping life-sustaining treatment to be morally equivalent to actively ending one's life as a physician or, you know, health provider. And it's a tall order, right, to make that analogy. I mean, I think the more pressing and the closer analogy is the one with suicide prevention, because the type of cases that people are worried about at policy level too is not the hospital setting type bedside cases, but people who are at home, have a chronic disability, be it mental, can be physical, often both, who say, I want to die, right? And who ordinarily would go through the sort of suicide prevention route. So I think it's all these different scenarios, and it's complicated. Back to your first question of why one is worried, because there are so many areas where we need clarification. You know, there's just so much work to be done, as opposed to, you know, other questions we have in bioethics where we have like decades of debate.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And we definitely want to get into talking more about the suicide prevention component later. I was going to say, just even outside the medical context and the health policy context, even just in all sorts of other aspects of life, we do assume the riskiness of a decision determines the threshold for how clear your judgment has to be. I mean, you can imagine if someone is on a mind-altering substance, you can't prevent them from, say, like, walking home in the rain, even though they should really take an Uber because it would be better for them. But you can stop them from maybe getting married or getting a tattoo or something like that. So we do make that kind of judgment all the time. I think it's interesting. The second requirement that we want to talk about is the unbearable suffering requirement. In the US, there's nothing akin to this requirement. There is, of course, a terminal illness requirement. So you have to have a terminal illness, that is an illness that will lead to a death by natural causes. And you have to have a prognosis of 6 months or less to live. So we're wondering what the idea is behind the unbearable suffering requirement. Is it that once you drop any sort of prognosis or terminal illness requirement, you sort of need the unbearable suffering and the irremediability requirements to serve as a proxy for whatever it is about having a terminal illness that makes us think it's reasonable to request MAID?
The way I see it is that part of the understanding is how it came historically, I think, because the US has its own system where, as you say, you have to have a terminal disorder and it has to be an informed autonomous request, and there is no suffering requirement. In the countries in Europe where this practice originated, and, you know, there's been discussions and cases since, you know, the late 70s, right? But then the laws were enacted in 20 years ago, in 2002. And I'm talking, I'll keep roughly Belgium and the Netherlands sort of as the test cases, because that's where most of our evidence and experience comes from, and where I also am from. And so in the Netherlands, which is really the first country, it all started with what they call, and it's translated, the justification of necessity. So sort of the beneficence in bioethics terms. The fact that when a physician is faced with a patient who suffers, you know, and nothing can be done, it's a beneficence argument to relieve suffering. And so in Europe, as a shorthand, it started from that, if you want, beneficence model. And from the very beginning, actually, there wasn't a clear restriction to terminal illness, even though the first cases were, mostly terminal. So I think we're sort of post hoc now trying to make sense of the different requirements in different countries where, to be honest, there aren't completely compatible or coherent. Because, I mean, one of the questions about suffering is, okay, if you say suffering is the basis and it's really what morally matters, then whether someone is terminally ill or not is really not what matters, right? And even to our point before, whether someone has capacity or not doesn't really matter either, right? You can make that point and people have made it, right? To say if that's what matters. The US doesn't have a formal suffering requirement, but it's implied. I mean, it's not implied in the law, but of course it's implied in practice. I mean, it's intended for someone who knows they might die soon and who want to end their life. And presumably there is some type of suffering, but it doesn't have to be physical suffering. But in the literature around this, it's sort of the assumption that it operates in the same way as it does in Europe, even in the US, but then it doesn't. And so that's where it kind of gets complicated.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting history that I was not aware of. I had assumed that there was a very conscious decision to not incorporate prognosis into the guidelines in Europe, but it's interesting to know that they really started from the ground with unbearable suffering. I'm curious if you can tell us a bit more about how unbearable suffering is defined and evaluated in places where there is this requirement.
Yeah. So the first thing is that in guidelines and in the law, it's the one thing that's understood to be patient subjective, right? I mean, the other two, the assumption is, well, you need a medical professional to sort of make that assessment, but suffering, the understanding is you still need a medical professional to assess it, but it's really up to the patient to say if they suffer unbearably, right? So subjectively defined, broadly speaking. And then there are sort of some guidance, I mean, in terms of how can a physician, because it's mostly physicians who do this, how can they ensure that that's the case? And, one of the things that we find in the Dutch guidelines is to say, well, to what extent is the suffering palpable to the physician? Like, to what extent can they understand? They don't say sympathize, right? But the idea is sort of, to what extent can you identify, understand, right? And that's one thing that's sort of tricky when it comes to mental disorders. And we can get into that. But sometimes the extent to which you identify with that suffering can be provider subjective, right? You might just sympathize with someone's suffering and less to someone's other. So that's when it comes to mental disorders. But broadly, it's in contrast with irremediability, the third requirement, where there's a lot of discussion, right? Suffering gets relatively less discussion because it's, and in fact, that's why people criticize it also, saying, look, it's actually like a non-condition, or it doesn't really do much work because there isn't really a way you can enforce some kind of safeguard around it.
I am glad that you mentioned the piece about provider subjectivity, because this is something that we hadn't planned to ask about, but I do want to ask you about, which is there evidence that there are biases in terms of different kinds of mental illnesses, how likely physicians are to judge that someone's suffering is palpable or unbearable?
Yeah, I mean, that's the evidence that we found in the study we did at the NIH, focusing on patients with personality disorders and depression. Just to give a quick background to the audience, in practice, most of the patients with a mental disorder who request and receive MAID in Europe, one, are women, and two, have depression and personality disorders, and often both. So it's not what some people might think, like chronic schizophrenia or bipolar, really, but it's a more common, if you want, conditions like depression and personality disorders, right? We mean like borderline personality disorder, sort of, people who have difficulties relating to others, having sort of stable mood, just sort of interpersonal difficulties. So in that study we did at the NIH, we actually found, and that was the first time, evidence that indeed physician subjectivity plays a role. And what we use in or refer to clinically as countertransference, it's a well-known phenomenon that psychiatrists, psychologists know that guidelines had sort of cautioned against, right? It's sort of the reactions that a provider can have towards their patient, be it positive or negative. I mean, It's all clinicians working in mental health know about this. And the idea is that it's sort of part of the work to understand why you feel maybe irritation towards a certain patient and what it tells about what their experiences have been, right? So that's this whole sort of complex clinical thing. But bottom line is that when these sort of neutral guidelines that actually were written for physical disorders primarily to say someone suffers, okay, make sure that they actually really suffer. Make sure that you feel it's not fake. Not fake, but maybe not serious enough, right? Make sure that you feel it too. And that means it's serious enough. And yet in psychiatry, if you feel it too, that actually can say something about you and not necessarily about the severity of suffering. And so that, I mean, that was one evidence for this phenomenon of provider subjectivity. And of course, downstream, the worry of like, well, physicians ultimately are the ones making that decision. So do they make decisions based on their own sort of appraisal of who suffers most or beyond a certain bar?
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess one question I have then is you might think that physicians could react positively or negatively to a patient to just cast this in very broad strokes. Obviously, your reactions are more nuanced than that. And you might think that the positive reaction could cause you to prescribe MAID more readily because you might have more empathy. But you also might think that the negative reaction could make you more likely to prescribe MAID because maybe you think that this person's life is less worth living. And so it sounds like the evidence that suggests that patients with personality disorders are often those receiving MAID suggests to me that the second theory might be more true in that we know that physicians often have a hard time relating to patients with personality disorders and often have a hard time sort of providing the same level of care that we might hope that they would provide to every other patient. Do you think that that might be part of what's going on here? Physicians are saying they don't like this patient that much and they maybe do consider their lives less worth living or something like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, definitely we have ample evidence about how patients with personality disorders are considered difficult. People might not necessarily consciously act on sort of lack of sympathy, right? Of being like, well, I don't like this patient. But the sense of hopelessness, though, I mean, beyond, you know, oh, it's a difficult patient, let's go ahead, right? I'd like to think, you know, and this is not what you were saying, but sometimes this is what people are worried about, right? But in more sort of subtle ways of a shared hopelessness, for sure. And it has to be actually unbearable, hopeless suffering. And so that sense of hopelessness, which is actually sort of characteristic of some personality disorders, the sense of helplessness, hopelessness, right? And when that's actually your legal requirement, that gets complicated.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Let's move now to talking about the third criterion, which is irremediability. So we can think of this condition as requiring that there are no reasonable treatment options or cures available for a patient's condition. The idea is not that it must be impossible to cure or treat the patient's condition, but rather that none of the available options are reasonable given how likely they are to work and what costs and burdens they involve. And I take it that one of the biggest controversies in this area is whether irremediability should be defined objectively or subjectively. So in other words, whether we're trying to determine that a patient has no treatment options that are reasonable from some objective medical perspective, or if we're leaving the matter of what counts as a reasonable treatment option entirely up to the patient and the patient's perspective. In the Netherlands and Belgium, you see a more objective criterion. So guidelines say that clinicians should assess irremediability, quote, in light of the diagnosis and prognosis from an objective medical psychiatric perspective and according to current medical understanding. Meanwhile, in Canada, currently the law defines irremediability totally subjectively in terms of what the patient considers reasonable. In some of your work, you say that an objective standard of irremediability is inadequate or too much to hope for in psychiatry. Why do you think that an objective standard is not workable? And do you think that using a subjective standard is better, or where do you fall on this issue?
So yes, the question of irremediability or incurability, if we want to put it in a simple way, but irremediability is a term that's used in this context, is there to ensure that MAID is the last resort option, right? And so it's supposed to do a lot of work. I mean, it's understood that you know, if you can suffer unbearably today and tomorrow, but what really makes it significant is that it cannot be remedied. I mean, that's the gist of it. And so the takeaway is that policymakers, when they made these laws, had physical disorders in mind. And in fact, that's how it started. One court case added mental disorders, but initially it started with physical disorders. And so the assumption was that, okay, look, we're going to have this law and we're going to leave it up to the medical community, right? They can say when something is incurable. And so the assumption is that there is a consensus, you know, within the medical community, and they draw from that consensus and apply their knowledge and expertise in that objective, you know, objective in the sense of it's supposed to be based on clinical findings. And the trouble is that in psychiatry, there just is no such consensus. I mean, there just isn't anything in place like what we have with, you know, to bring in the example of cancer, right? Because when the medical community says, well, based on, you know, these lab findings, these, you know, scanner findings and so on, you fall in that stage, and that stage means this, right? You know, late stage pancreatic cancer is incurable, right? And when it's incurable, we know it's incurable. So it's a whole system that the medical community agrees on. I mean, bottom line, there just isn't anything like that in psychiatry.
Yeah, no, this is super interesting. And we had wanted to ask about this because I guess you might think there are like a couple different reasons that prognosticating in psychiatry is hard. One is just that it can be harder to predict the course of mental illness. So like we know that advanced pancreatic cancer is likely to end in death from advanced pancreatic cancer, but with something like depression, it waxes and wanes. And, you know, people can not experience depression for 20 years and then experience depression again. And it's just the course is more complicated. But you might think that another reason that it's hard to prognosticate about mental illness is just that the outcome you're trying to prognosticate about is inherently less well-defined. So it's like, there's this question about, will someone's mental health improve? How are we going to even assess that? How much does it have to improve by in order for us to determine that they're cured or whatever? Which is much harder to predict than, is someone going to die or not? Which is this sort of well-defined binary outcome. So I'm curious, what do you think it is about mental illness that makes it so hard to prognosticate about? And is that kind of an inherent feature of mental illness, or is this something that we could make progress on by gathering more data, using machine learning, whatever, to sort of be able to improve our prognostication ability within mental illness?
So the way I see it, the question of prognostication, of prediction, there's no doubt we're going to make progress. And, you know, part of the study we did recently looking at how well actually can psychiatrists predict, and we also looked at what machine learning can do today. And right, so today it's not at the level where it can bring us anything closer, right? It's sort of at chance level. So that's not great. But, you know, it's fair to think or to hope that machine learning can be more accurate. And then we'll still have to define what do we find accurate enough. The difficulty, though, I think, is to your earlier point of what's your outcome, because it's one thing to say, can we predict whether someone will have symptoms still 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line? I mean, that seems a long shot, but, you know, depending on how you define what recovery is, to use that term, right? Is recovery absence of symptoms? Is it not necessarily absence of symptoms, but having a fulfilled life, right? That's another sort of definition of recovery. We have in psychiatry, and this is the transformation of the field itself, different understandings of recovery, including the more emerging models like the neurodiversity model, right? That even question whether certain symptoms or mental differences need to be remedied at all. So these are the tough questions.
Yeah. You mentioned the study you did where you assessed how good psychiatrists are at prognosticating about the trajectories of patients' mental illness. Can you say a few words about what you found?
Yeah. We looked at that objective requirement in the sense of, well, what if physicians, psychiatrists who find themselves, right, they have a patient in front of them and they want to do, right, to the best of their abilities, apply the medical state of the art. What does it look like? And we took depression as the paradigm case because depression is often what's used in these debates. So we went and looked at treatment-resistant depression. How is it defined? So that was one question. What do we know about long-term outcomes of people with treatment-resistant depression and treat and looking at individual prediction, right? And we looked also at machine learning algorithmic predictions. And so the bottom line, you know, is that One, and this isn't news, I think, to psychiatrists or people in the field, but there are, you know, over 150 definitions of what treatment-resistant depression means. So that's the first thing. And it's, you know, importantly for people who may be less familiar, in the field of research, it's defined with a very low threshold of, you know, you have failed two antidepressants. I mean, which is not what people think of when they think of a euthanasia case, right? They think of people who've had, and this is the case, like the people who receive it, you know, tens of years or the often chronic disease, right? But so TRD, so first is like, what do we mean? Treatment refractory is not the same as what it means with treatment refractory cancer, right? That's a major big point. Also, incidentally, the term was coined as an index in PubMed, you know, the platform research community uses. That term started to be indexed only 10 years ago, 2012. So in looking at studies that have a cohort of people with TRD and how they fare in the long run, we know way less than we know, for example, with people with AIDS, right? HIV and how that progresses. So that's a sort of, it's a side thing, but it's just to sort of, you know, the point of how little we know. So that was the definitional thing. The second is, what do we know about long-term outcomes? And surprisingly, there are a handful, five studies, small sampled studies only, that look at naturalistic long-term outcomes. And by long-term in those studies, it was a couple of years maximum, right? It was not decades. So this is all to say, if physicians want to rely on what's our group level knowledge of, if someone has that type of depression, how do they fare on the long run? We know very, very little. That's the bottom line. And then third is, how accurate are the predictions? We found when we look at the machine learning studies out there that the closest and the best was at chance level, right? 50%, which is, yeah, like flipping a coin. So that's, in a nutshell, the result of that study. To your earlier point of, well, does that mean we should reject the objective standard and revert to the subjective one? I think that was a great question, right? My take is that no, but I think actually what the challenging and also the exciting thing is to try to actually do the work of defining, okay, what do we mean by recovery in the first place, in a sort of inclusive type of definition, as opposed to saying, let's just go with a purely subjective definition, because then we enter a different sort of realm of challenges.
Yeah, definitely. Could you tell us a little bit about the oversight mechanisms for medical aid in dying in the countries where it's legal? Our general sense is that there's a system of retrospective review where clinicians have to file a report after they prescribe MAID, explaining what they did and why, and then a panel reviews these reports. Is that right? And if so, do you think that this kind of oversight mechanism is sufficient?
So it's right in that in countries like Belgium and the Netherlands, and everywhere really, it's a retrospective review. So that means, you know, physicians provide euthanasia or physician assisted suicide and then have to report the case. And then there's a commission that looks at the cases and ensures that physician followed the legal requirements. The reason it's this way, right? Because often people, when they hear this thing, how is this possible? How come there isn't sort of, you know, a better type of sort of evaluation beforehand? And there are different types of safeguards in terms of it's not just one physician, there has to be a consultant, right? But there isn't commissions typically don't assess it before a person dies. And so people are worried about that. The reason, again, to come back historically, the reason this has been put in place this way is because the idea was that they didn't want the whole system to be policing type of things for clinicians, right? It all originated in that, you know, beneficence between physician and patient. And the idea was that there should be an element of trust, that because if it's all in a climate of fear of prosecution, then it won't be applied. And then there's no point in having such a law. That was kind of the idea, right? One might say, well, yeah, but then it's really up to individual clinicians. And that is the case, right? Because in Belgium, the Netherlands, you need to have an independent consultant, but that advice is not binding. And in that way, it's maybe less regulated than many other things, including, you know, application of devices and so on, that have a sort of more rigorous system.
I mean, do you feel like the retrospective review is sufficient, or in your mind, do you think it would make sense to have some sort of prospective review?
To me, it comes back to the question of safeguards versus what are the parameters for doing what we're doing. People often frame it in terms of, well, whatever worries we have, we can have better procedural safeguards. And one could be something like that, right? The commission beforehand, ensuring that people are psychiatrists and not GPs, right? Because majority actually are GPs and not psychiatrists who do it. So there are all sorts of things. But to me, really, it would only make sense if we tackle those upstream questions first. Very fundamental questions, actually, of like, how do we define a mental disorder? How do we define an incurable mental disorder? Because safeguards, I mean, per definition, is the sets of things in place to make sure that, in this case, physicians follow the rules, right? But to me, the problem is, what rules should they even follow? And so I think I worry a little bit that policy discussions that are happening right now in Belgium and the Netherlands get too much into that, where they add stuff like the physician also has to talk to the family if possible, or physician has to consult not one, but two other clinicians, you know, and I feel like it just, there are just so many things you could come up with, but really the work that needs to be done is more fundamental than that.
Yeah, this is actually a really good transition point, because we wanted to now move to discussing some of the worries that people might have about legalizing MAID for mental illness that might still apply even if there were really robust safeguards in place. The idea being that even if you crafted like the best possible MAID policy, people still have concerns, and we want to talk about some of those. In particular, there are three concerns we wanted to talk about. The first is a worry about there being an inherent tension between legalizing MAID for mental illness and sustaining a meaningful commitment to suicide prevention. The second is the worry that legalizing MAID for mental illness might take the onus off government actors to improve the lives of the mentally ill by improving psychosocial services. And the third is a worry about the expressive power of legalizing MAID for mental illness. That is, the statement it might make about whether people living with severe mental illness have lives worth living.
Right. So let's start with the suicide prevention topic. A concern that you've raised in your work is that because people who attempt and complete traditional suicides and people who seek and die by MAID for mental illness are similar in most respects, we can't firmly distinguish between traditional suicidality and the desire to seek MAID on the basis of a psychiatric condition. And you claim that this fact poses a problem for the relationship between legalizing MAID and suicide prevention efforts. We want to better understand why. So one thing that you say is that existing safeguards for MAID are not enough to filter out people who are suicidal. We're a little bit confused about this claim. So it seems like you and others in this research area want to draw a meaningful distinction between being suicidal on the one hand and wanting to receive MAID on the other. And so this suggests that when you say someone is suicidal, you don't just mean that they want to end their life. You mean something more, something normative, like perhaps they want to end their life and should be prevented from doing so. If that's right, then the meaningful distinction between people who exhibit suicidality and people who legitimately request MAID is that those who are suicidal want to end their lives and should be prevented from doing so, while those who legitimately request MAID want to end their lives and should not be prevented from doing so. But the safeguards and requirements that we put in place for MAID seem like they're designed to make precisely this distinction. They're meant to filter out people who should be prevented from ending their lives, either because they're not capable of making sound decisions, or because they're being pressured, or because they're not suffering unbearably, or perhaps most commonly, because their condition actually is treatable. So unless there are further reasons why we think that people should in general be prevented from ending their lives when they want to, over and above any legitimate concerns that we have about decision-making capacity or the severity of their suffering or the remediability of their condition, we don't see why the current safeguards aren't already designed to filter out suicidality, that is, to filter out people who want to end their lives but should be prevented from doing so. So could you say a little bit more about what your concern is with respect to these safeguards?
I think a way to put it is that often what people mean or refer to when they say, look, there really isn't that much of a tension because we have safeguards or just a system in place to make sure that those who want to die really want to die, and you know, we can filter out those whose death wish is impulsive or those who we would consider traditionally suicidal. Actually, effectively, what they're saying is, well, those whose wish is irrational or not really thought true, or we feel like, you know, we can treat them, we can filter them out clinically and morally, that's what we should be doing. What I want to draw attention to is that it's a bit of a false kind of dichotomy in the sense that, you know, what they have in mind when they say suicidal is sort of acutely suicidal, right? Like people, you know, who are obviously in need of treatment. I don't know, someone, you know, on a bridge and wants to jump, what we call acute suicidality. And there is obvious distress or however we want to describe it. It's actually not well characterized in the field, acute versus chronic. What I want to say is that where it's less clear of a distinction is between chronic suicidality and a request for aid. And that's the vast majority of suicidal patients. I mean, there are just a lot of people who think about death over a long time and who there's no question they would pass a capacity test. It's unclear, coming back to irremediability, whether it's really irremediable, right? And that kind of distinction isn't that easy to make. And that's why I'm coming back to the earlier point. It comes then to the question of, well, is death in that case a good or a bad thing for them? Because in countries where there is no euthanasia or assisted suicide, the assumption is that that person's death should be prevented. So to me, they're very much is a tension, but it's not between what people think it is, that it's chronic suicidality or a chronic wish to die, not necessarily actually in a person with mental disorder, right? But that's the tension, I think.
Yeah, okay, that's helpful. I guess I don't totally understand the work that the acute versus chronic suicidality is doing here. And maybe one way of putting it is, it seems like the people who are acutely suicidal wouldn't be eligible for MAID, at least in the short term, right? Assuming that the policy had been designed in some sort of reasonable way. And so then it seems like the case that some people might worry about is the case of the more chronically suicidal patients who then, instead of being chronically suicidal and getting access to suicide prevention services and so on, now instead seek MAID. And I guess what I'm wondering is, like, if we think that they satisfy the MAID criteria, you know, you've raised this point of, like, for some of these patients, their conditions might not actually be irremediable and so on. And I take that, you know, that's all granted. But if they do meet the criteria for MAID, why should we prevent them from accessing MAID?
Well, to me, it comes back to the question of, are the requirements in place adequate for mental disorder? That's really the higher level question. Because one sort of argumentative strategy that people have made in the field to say, look, these are the requirements, right? Let's start with those three. And there are a number of papers like that, right? Where we say, look, these are the requirements for physical disorders. And look, we can think of someone who is, let's say, has depression, is chronically suicidal, right? They can meet the first voluntary requests. They clearly suffer and they can be incurable. And to be clear, in some cases, it can be incurable, right? I'm not saying it's never curable. I'm saying we don't know what we're saying when we say incurable, right? So that's, I mean, a trouble for that argument strategy, actually, because, you know, what do you really mean? But you could presumably say, look, we can think of a case of someone who meets those requirements. Hence, they should have access, right? Or this policy should be in place. And not to do it is actually to discriminate against that group of people, right? But I think the way I see it is that we should look at, well, first, you know, we have two groups. We know there are differences between the groups. We know they're entitled to the same level of protection and justice. I mean, obviously, we want to treat people with mental disorders with the same level of quality care. And the question is that the same as saying the requirements should be the same? Or vice versa, if we apply those same broad requirements, does that guarantee equal protection and adequate protection for that group?
Okay, this is really helpful. And I do actually want to follow up on this, because I take your point that it's like you have a bunch of requirements that were designed for, I mean, I hate the dichotomy between physical and mental illness, but for the purposes of this conversation, you have requirements that were designed for people with physical illnesses that are now being applied more broadly to people with mental illnesses. And so there's this concern that the criteria that were established actually are not the right ones. And I guess one reaction I have is, like, the criteria to me actually seems sort of reasonable. I think my reaction is, if it is the case that someone has really serious depression and they are having unbearable suffering, and we do have reason to think that their depression is incurable and they do reflect on this decision and voluntarily request MAID, One worry you might have is that it's not actually possible to know these things. And I totally grant that. But putting that practical concern aside for a minute, I don't really see why we should be in the business of denying access to MAID for a patient who we were really confident satisfied these criteria. And you seem to be sort of more on the fence about this. And I guess I'm wondering, you seem to perhaps be concerned that the criteria are not sufficient for people with mental illness. And so I'm wondering, are there criteria that you think need to be added? What would it take for that to sort of look like a reasonable request to you?
Yeah, I think to your point of reasonable, you know, it could be reasonable, right? It can be reasonable to assume that for some people it's justified. You know, I don't want to actually, you know, make even a judgment on that, because the question is, as a matter of policy, is it reasonable? And if as a matter of policy, we don't know how to define incurable. I mean, I think that's a very hard problem, because how is it supposed to be, you know, applied, you know? And trying to circle back to the suicide prevention thing, you know, you could say, I mean, and I understand, right? If someone's chronically suicidal and they have chronic depression, why should we not grant them MAID? You know, another major issue is then, yeah, but then how do you justify continuing suicide prevention? It poses fundamental questions for suicide prevention today. Because a clinician, and I've had this myself, and clinicians are in that dilemma where they have a patient and technically they have diametrically opposed responses they could choose from. One providing death and one going all the way to involuntarily committing them. And that's just a serious moral issue. I mean, we just can't bypass it.
Right. Yeah. I think any remaining confusion I have about the suicide prevention issue is still about what people really mean by suicide prevention. It seems to me as though it's getting people with suicidal ideation or prior attempts into contact with the quality mental health care that they need. And so, I mean, you might actually think that legalizing MAID could get people who are experiencing suicidality to access mental health services when they wouldn't otherwise get them. The thought is like, if you legalize MAID, then presumably you're going to have more people seek it. And either those people will receive it or they won't. And if they do, then presumably they're people who, at the end of the day, we can't permissibly stop from going through with ending their lives. And if they don't receive it, then maybe those people are more likely to get filtered into the mental health care system, you know, flawed as it is. So what do you think of that line of thought that kind of views legalizing MAID as not intention, but actually working in tandem with suicide prevention?
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree that, well, certainly this discussion forces us to think about what is suicide prevention, because really part of the difficulty is that there actually isn't that much work done on, you know, philosophy of suicide prevention or just the ethics of it. You know, it's being applied all the time. And even clinically speaking, you know, there's just a lot of room for improvement. And so definitely if this can be a cautionary tale in the other direction, right, of being like, look, MAID really forces us to think, based on what are we justified to just involuntarily commit people because they say they want to die, you know, when often, you know, they would, again, pass the bar for capacity. So ethically speaking, I mean, what do you use as a justification to override their wishes or even, you mean, you know, to violate their human rights, lock people up and so on. So there is no doubt that this actually forces us to maybe also improve suicide prevention. And I think that's a positive note. The thing about the argument of if we do it, we're actually gonna improve care. People now have a way to talk about their death wish that they don't have in a country that doesn't have MAID. To me, that's a little, someone has described it as like, you know, using fire, you know, to extinguish fire kind of thing. Like, yes, it makes sense. On the other hand, we are talking about a policy that, you know, end people's lives, right? So if what you want to get at is better care for people, or just like a more open system where it's not based on knee-jerk reactions of like, you know, you get a SWAT team if you're right. I mean, you know, there are some significant problems. I'm not sure like the quickest way to solve it is to have a system in place where it can go either way and people effectively, you know, their lives are ended, because in the absence of very clear clarification of what we're doing. And it's a high opportunity cost of wrongful death. I mean, it's no joke, right? And it's all ages. We know from the research I've done and others, right? It's anywhere between 18 and 50. I mean, so we're talking regularly about very young people also. So it's, as Steinberg has written about, it's not enough to find one ideal patient to justify policy for a whole group of patients. And I think that's sort of, that's the main gist of it. It could be, but we need more work.
Yeah. Just to summarize a little bit where I think maybe we ended up on this piece, what I kind of hear is that there's more philosophical normative work needed on basically what would be the criteria where if we could implement them well in an ideal world, we would be able to correctly identify who should have access to MAID and who shouldn't have access to MAID. And then there's a separate question of the policy and how you actually implement these guidelines in a reasonable way. And that piece is just really, really hard, and it's inherently messy. And so to some extent, the sort of more basic normative philosophical question becomes moot if we can't actually figure out how to actualize this in some reasonable way. And that's a point I totally grant. So I want to return to this last thing you said about how we don't want to base policy on individual patients, because the second argument we wanted to discuss against legalizing MAID for psychiatric illnesses is that doing so might take the onus off government actors to improve the lives of the mentally ill by improving and expanding access to mental health care and important psychosocial services. And the concern here is that some people will be approved for MAID on the basis of their mental illnesses, but will actually be seeking MAID because they lack access to good mental health care, or because they are poor or unhoused or suffering from other kinds of injustices. And the same worry has already arisen with respect to disability in places like Canada, where you can request MAID on the basis of a non-life-threatening physical disability. And there are a dozen or so news stories out of Canada that illustrate this concern vividly. So one example that I think a lot of people have heard about is this case of a 54-year-old man with debilitating back pain, Amir Farsoud, who sought medical aid in dying when he found out he was going to be unhoused, citing his rationale, the fact that although he did not want to die, he did not think he could survive being homeless, and he preferred what he considered to be a more dignified death via MAID to a slow death on the streets. And I think we all look at that and reasonably respond with horror. And after Mr. Farsoud's story caught media attention, some strangers set up a GoFundMe page for him, which crowdfunded more than $60,000, leading him to reconsider his request for MAID. So this is obviously a sobering story, and it's not hard to imagine similar things happening to people who are suffering from mental illness, considering how poor access to mental health care is and how limited psychosocial services are across the board. And so I guess this is all to say it's clearly bad if cases like those I just described occur at all. But it's also really hard to craft precise policies or ones that guarantee that people who should receive MAID always get it, and people who shouldn't receive MAID never do. Wherever we draw the line in determining access to MAID, there's going to be what we might call false positives, or people who receive MAID when we think they shouldn't have, and false negatives, or people who were denied MAID when we think they should have been able to access it. Do you think cases like the one I just described will be sufficiently common under the proposed Canadian policy to warrant revising the policy to prohibit them? Or are these kinds of cases the tragic but exceedingly rare downsides of an otherwise sound policy?
Well, because you tailored the question to Canada, I'll take the luxury to like focus on Canada. The reason there is so much worry is that Canada has defined its irremediability requirement subjectively and is different, right, than the European countries. So de facto, you risk the suffering and irremediability to sort of collapse in BU1. And so really any type of suffering could, you know, it doesn't then really matter if there are remedies or not, right? So that's a worry that's almost specific. I mean, not specific to Canada, but I think, yes, we can probably expect those cases to be common under that Canadian law. So I think that goes towards the worry of the disability community mostly, but not only, right? Of like, who does it target? Because to put it bluntly, some people say, look, when it's not limited to terminal disorders, it's clearly discriminatory because it's not about anyone who suffers, right? You have to have some chronic condition, be it mental or physical. So the worry is like you're asking physicians to make assumptions about whose life is worth living only in people who have a disability or chronic condition. And the worry coming back to the, you know, what I think are the deeper questions is that in the absence of clarification of what work unbearable suffering and your amenability does, you risk conflating them all, where just having a chronic disability is conflated with suffering equals irremediable and equals, you know, you're better off dead. And I think the discussions have been very heated because, you know, the word eugenics has been used, right? And they're like, look, this is actually eugenics, right? You're actually making a law that targets certain people and saying, you know, state should actually provide a system that allows them to die and allows physicians to do that. I think regardless of intent, right, I'd like to think people who are in favor do not have conscious eugenics intentions. But it is a serious problem if it's subjectively defined, which then actually amounts to what the physician finds and their implicit biases. And it's just, you know, one big murky terrain, really. What I think as a matter of policy, what we need to look at is a certain policy discriminatory, like the effect of it, right? Like we do in other realms. We all come at this from a place of compassion, right? And no one means to discriminate. And I'd like to think that's true. But the problem is, that's not enough, right? We can all be well-intentioned. We still need to actually look downstream at the effect.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Let's transition to talking about the third worry, because our questions are actually really related to a lot of the things that you were just talking about. So a third argument against legalizing MAID for mental illness has to do with what we've been calling the expressive power of doing so. And the concern here is that legalizing it might communicate that the lives of people with mental illnesses are not worth living or are less worth living than other lives are, since the message that the policy might send is that we as a society think it's often reasonable or understandable or in someone's best interest to end their own life rather than choosing to live with severe mental illness. Again, the same concern has arisen in the disability context. But in that context, there's also been a lot of debate even amongst disability advocates, because there's also been a counter argument raised on the basis of expressive power, which is that not legalizing MAID also expresses disrespect for disabled people in a different way, since it expresses that they are incapable of making decisions for themselves or exercising autonomy over their own lives and their end of life choices. We could say the same of not legalizing MAID for mental illness. So there seems to be a tension here, even when it comes to thinking about what the policy expresses. Where do advocates and mental health professionals tend to fall on this issue?
You know, there are different layers to it. I think what the sort of mad pride community, I mean, you know, very strong neurodiversity paradigm would very much push back against the very simple narrative of if you have a mental disorder, your life is shitty. I mean, just to be sort of blunt, right? A lot of people do not want to get rid of their quote symptoms. And again, that's a significant conceptual challenge for this whole question, because autism, for example, which is an example that people might be familiar with in context, in relation to neurodiversity, where we know there's a very strong autistic community, people saying, look, it's part of my identity. I am autistic and, you know, using first language. It's not something I want to be cured for. I don't need to be cured, right? But similarly, actually, you know, more broadly, like just because you have psychosis doesn't mean that you suffer unbearably. So maybe, I mean, to your very initial point of a lot of people sometimes assume if you have a mental illness, you're irrational. Similarly, a lot of stereotypes and preconceptions about if you have a mental illness, you must have just a terrible life, right? Or it just must be horrible. I think, I don't know if we can actually get close to whether really there is, you know, sort of an actual judgment of, as a society, we're saying your lives are not worth living. I'm sure, you know, there are good arguments in favor, and definitely it's a worry. But I think the maybe closer to home sort of immediate impact is just very practical, almost, of like, how do clinicians go about this, right? You practice, and I was practicing in a country where this is permitted. You know, how do you even communicate it to your other patients when someone in your ward received euthanasia, right? We're nowhere near to understanding, you know, how do we say, yes, your patient, you know, who was in group therapy up until last week, now received euthanasia referred by us, right? I mean, how does that rhyme with the therapy we're continuing to do? But it's not too early to understand, you know, the moral distress that comes with this in practice. Which is why, like, a majority of psychiatrists in those countries do not want to provide euthanasia, do not want to do it. And in fact, don't do it. The majority, and we know from our studies and from surveys, are GPs that are dedicated to do this. But surveys, including national survey in the Netherlands, shows that actually over time, psychiatrists have been less willing to do it. And of course, one thing is to ask, well, do you think in general people should have access, you know, broadly speaking, in an abstract sense? The second is, would you do it with your patient? And that's just a very, very low group of psychiatrists who are willing to do it. But these are really, I mean, that's when it trickles down from the very high level moral questions to practice, right? Like, you have a patient and, you know, should you refer them to your colleague knowing next week, in 2 weeks from now, they might not be there anymore? Should you? It's huge. It's really huge.
Yeah. One follow-up on this piece about clinicians over time becoming less eager about prescribing MAID. One thing that you might think is going on there is that as an increasing number of patients seek MAID out, the average patient who's seeking it out is just less obviously eligible under the criteria. So that could cause physicians to say, like, I don't know, I'm getting less comfortable with this because the average person who's requesting it is no longer the patient who has 6 months to live and is obviously suffering horrible pain. Do you think that is what's going on, or do you think there's something else?
I mean, it's definitely true that the number of cases and requests have been increasing as people are just more aware of this. And this is fairly recent, actually, because initially when the laws were enacted, there just weren't many cases. But as for why clinicians are more ambivalent, I think, I mean, yeah, part of it is to what you're saying. They're just seeing more cases. And just in general, I mean, it becomes so common. And the guidelines, actually, the revised Dutch guidelines say it somewhere. They're like, well, obviously, people are going to bring it up because they hear it in the media. So it's not necessarily always a request, but people might frame their death wish differently. I mean, they might, instead of saying, I think about suicide, they say, I think about euthanasia, right? And coming back to that dilemma, it's almost like word choice, right? At this point, should it be based on what word the patient uses, right? So, I mean, there's just that sort of confusion on the terrain, on the front line. I think actually what clinicians, and I'm hearing this from colleagues in Belgium, they want guidance on, you know, thinking through where they stand even, you know, because, I mean, all of a sudden it changes your practice so deeply. And physicians don't even have time really to think this through. I mean, let alone the field that, you know, still catching up. Where do I, what even are my views, right? You have to catch up with things that are moving so fast.
Yeah. So this seems like a good point to transition to the last thing we wanted to discuss, which is what the future of policy around MAID is likely to look like. Our sense is that in general, MAID is becoming more widely accepted and that things are trending in the direction of permitting MAID for a broader variety of conditions, including psychiatric conditions. Is that a correct perception? And are there any places where you think that things are trending in the opposite direction?
Well, I think one actually doesn't exclude the others. It's almost like a not a cycle, but it's, you know, as people are sort of more, I think in general, right, especially in Europe, the public we know from surveys and clinicians are in favor of MAID for terminal illness, at least in those countries for sure. And then, of course, when you ask, well, if someone's going to die in 6 months, then why not for someone's going to die in 12 months? And, you know, and sort of broadening, right? And seeing a general from surveys, that kind of general, maybe positive attitude towards it. Once it actually becomes real, the tide kind of turns back and they're like, oh, wait, I used to think one thing and now actually I'm not that sure. But when you actually come close, like clinicians in Canada, right? When they actually, all of a sudden, the law is there and you have to refer your patient and it becomes very real, you know, and then you do a survey, you know, we have data from Europe, then it kind of reverts back and they're like, hey, you know what? I'm not so sure. And relatively recent data from the Netherlands show, okay, support for MAID for physical disorders, terminal disorders, cancer, but also other physical disorders is 85%. Mental disorders, 30%, right? That's when you ask them, would you do it? So that kind of divide, you know, I think views change. I think we can assume that when you ask those who are actually tasked to do it, support is not high. And in fact, one Canadian survey showed that when looking at mental disorders and particularly personality disorders, support was like very low, like 9%. But I think it's not linear, I guess is my point, is that we can expect that it's not linear.
One clarificatory point on the survey. So you mentioned that oftentimes support is high, policy gets implemented, and then support drops. I'm wondering, do you see that with the physical conditions? You mentioned these 85% rates of public support for made for physical conditions. Has that remained constant over time, or has that fallen too?
So that particular survey was with physicians and not the public, but it, you know, so that was one study and that wasn't over time. The data we had over time are specific about mental disorders. And yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure, yeah, there is a sort of backtracking that we didn't see with other sort of chronic physical disorders.
Okay, that's helpful. Well, we're nearing the end of our time. So we like to close the podcast by asking our guests, what is one rule or norm broadly related to what we've been talking about today that you would change if you could, and why?
You know, at the risk of it sounding trivial, but I think it's not, having an actual inclusive debate. I mean, ideally, you know, it would take time to actually have enough evidence and enough actual conceptual work to have a solid debate. One that isn't purely rhetorical, right? On both ends, it quickly sort of gets ugly and rhetorical, and that just helps no one. Humility, I think, is another one. I mean, you know, humility in taking stock of how complex this is, and that as a society, we've never had a society, this kind of policy that's state funded. You know, it's novel. I mean, it's one of the ethical questions of life and death that hasn't been debated in this form for decades and decades, where we have solid data across the world that we can compare. No, we have data sparse in different countries where a lot of the debate then just stays at that superficial level of like, well, but we are not that country. And that just doesn't get us anywhere. You know, that sort of provincial type thinking. It's a global issue. It's changing very fast. We're seeing very quick changes across Europe over the past few years with major players like Spain, Germany, Austria. I mean, the UK is now debating. So it's almost like we need to all, I think, act responsibly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's end things there. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Marie. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bioethical is written and edited by me, Sophie Joubert, and Leah Pearson, with production by audiolift.co. If you want to support the show, please subscribe, rate, and review it wherever you get your podcasts and recommend it to a friend. You can also follow us on Twitter at Leah_Pearson and Sophie H. Joubert to be notified about new episodes. And you can sign up on our website, bioandethical.com, to receive emails when new episodes are released. We promise we won't spam you, but we may reach out to let you know about upcoming guests and give you the opportunity to submit questions. Our music is written by Nina Corey and performed by the band Social Skills. We're supported by a grant from Amplify Creative Grants. Links to papers we reference and other helpful resources are available on our website, bioandethical.com. You can submit feedback there or email us at bioandethical@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and for your support.